This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, April 13th, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. Why has fear of terrorism persisted so long and so substantially after 9/11? John Mueller is co-author of a new Cato report, Public Opinion and Counterterrorism Policy. We spoke this week about fear, behavior, and government overreaction to the specter of terrorist plots. When we look at polls about what the public thinks about terrorism, you know, or in general, any topic, really, you see that you can go a certain amount of depth in people's opinions before certain contradictions start to emerge. Are there clear contradictions about how Americans think about terrorism?
Well, I don't know if you want to call it a contradiction, but there is sort of a surprising development. That's quite surprising to me when I started looking into this. There's been almost no change in Americans' attitudes toward terrorism since 9/11, despite the fact, of course, there haven't been any big attacks of that sort, the number of people being killed is about 6 per year since 9/11 by Islamist terrorists and so forth. But if you look, for example, right after 9/11, they asked the question, do you think there'll be another large attack killing large numbers of Americans in the near future? And 72% said they thought it was likely. That number hasn't really changed at all. It bounces around a little bit with events. But the last time it was asked is still about 72%, 71%. And what I did, and my co-author Mark Stewart, is we looked at a whole bunch of trend lines on terrorism since 9/11. And that's the general conclusion. And on some questions, there's a drop or a change from 9/11 to the end of 2001. But then it hasn't changed much at all since that time. Other questions, like the one I just mentioned, haven't changed at all in any sense since 9/11. So it's rather puzzling because you would have expected obviously you expect the numbers to be high after the initial shock of 9/11. But what we're finding is that even when that shock presumably has mellowed at least somewhat, and when officials and the press are paying at least somewhat less attention to the issue, and when bin Laden has been, you know, cashiered, and when there has been very little terrorism in the developed world compared to what the fears were certainly in 9/11, you would expect some sort of erosion, and it simply hasn't happened.
So what do we know about people's revealed preferences with respect to terrorism? I mean, are people, if their expectations are high that these events are going to occur at some point in the future, is there some behavioral change that we ought to observe?
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be necessarily all the big a connection between that and behavior. I mean, after 9/11, of course, there's a big fear about getting on airplanes, and that died out in a couple of years. And you don't see people worried necessarily about their personal safety, particularly, even before and after 9/11. If you ask just a bland question, it doesn't mention terrorism, but how do you feel about your personal safety, freedom from a violent attack? And it basically didn't change much at all at 9/11. So it's not, and of course, property values didn't plummet in New York or Washington after 9/11 either. So behavioral effects seem to be less than, they haven't been, you know, huge. People have sort of taken it in their stride in that sense. They go back, you know, they still go to baseball games and stuff like that, though they frequently profess more worry about it beforehand. One of the things we sort of found, though, is that this is not so much about terrorism. It's about is international terrorism or Islamist terrorism. Fortunately, some of the questions go back to 1995. 1995 was the Timothy McVeigh attack on the government center in Oklahoma City. And at that time, people became, of course, quite alarmed about terrorism. But over the next few years, the questions were asked, and there was a distinct decline in concern about terrorism. So what's different about this is that this terrorism, which is seemed to be linked to some sort of rather spooky international conspiracy, has that as an important quality. It's not domestic terrorism. It's not terrorism per se, but it's international terrorism. And when we looked for comparisons, we came up with a couple. The best one probably is concern about domestic communists in the United States, because they too were sort of invisible. You can't really see them. You can't pick them out. You can't predict what they're going to do. They're dedicated to an international movement, which has as its goal of ultimately revolution and overthrowing the government. And so they're kind of spooky too. They're all part, and it's not clear exactly where the center of all this conspiracy is. When you look at public opinion on terror, concern about domestic communists. Now, this is not the Cold War, but the domestic communists. There is very little change from the height of the McCarthy period for another 10 or even 20 years, even though in that case, there was virtually nothing going on. There were no big cases. There was no case of a communist terrorist blowing up a defense factory or something like that. So there were very few real reminders. Nonetheless, despite that fact, concern about domestic communists did not really erode very much, certainly for 10 years and to a considerable degree for 20 years after the height of McCarthyism, say 1954 or so. And the other comparison is the ultimate spooky foreign adversary, which is the devil. The devil, of course, said to have had in his sway a bunch of witches, people in your country who look just like normal women, usually somewhat old and maybe a bit cranky, but nonetheless, you can't really necessarily tell which one is a witch and which is not. Between 1480 and about 1680 in Europe in particular, there was the witch craze in which tens of thousands of women, particularly sometimes men, but mostly women, were executed. And there seems to have been very little decline. There's no public opinion polls, of course, it took a long time for that fear to attenuate, maybe 200 years. So the ultimate spook, obviously, is the devil. And the handmaidens of the devil were these people who were living among you, just like terrorists or just like domestic communists. And they're dedicated to evil. And their loyalties are something that's international and rather spooky in scope.
Do people view terrorism as, I guess, different categories of terrorism? That is to say, Timothy McVeigh might have been viewed very differently from the 9/11 hijackers based upon what Americans thought their aims were?
Yes. You could argue that Timothy McVeigh wanted to overthrow the government. I mean, in fact, that's pretty much what he would have said. In other words, the right-wing Michigan militia types, he was sort of part of, were extremely hostile to the government of the United States and were willing to use violence, some of them at least, to try to bring it down. So they did have an existential goal, you might say. But the fears of them seem to be much more limited. There was a lot of terrorism in the United States in the 1950s and 1960s, but it was basically very much domestic, including some of the anti-Vietnam movement, Weathermen and some of their incarnations. But that basically sort of faded away. People have to go back and remind people that was the case, which is what I'm doing right now. So there's been a lot of terrorism around. A considerable number of people were killed, not huge numbers, but certainly comparable to the number of people who have been killed by Islamist terrorists since 9/11 in the United States. But people sort of brushed that aside and it went away. So it has something to do with, even Timothy McVeigh, who was tied to a movement of sorts, identified with the movement, certainly in the United States, and he obviously wanted to get revenge for what he felt was government encroachments on his thinking or way of life or his people, or the people he identified with, and killed 200 people or so with the explosion in 1995. Even he doesn't seem to. That's not good. That's not the same thing as a spooky international conspiracy, as far as we were able to see. He's not up there with the devil. He's not up there with Osama bin Laden.
So what explains the persistence of this concern, at least self-reported concern about terrorism. You and I have talked before about what you called the self-licking ice cream cone, which is agencies that are in the business of not just dealing with a threat, but in some cases also sort of ginning it up.
Yeah, that's the other part of the Cato paper we deal with, which is counterterrorism policy. One of the things you could certainly say, the data certainly support the following, is that although the United States has spent a trillion dollars, well over $1 trillion, on domestic counterterrorism policy, the TSA and the Department of Homeland Security and various protective and policing measures, spent a huge amounts of money. And one of the main reasons was that to reassure people and make them feel safe. That clearly, in the case of terrorism, has failed, abjectly failed, all these expenditures. And so in many respects, we sort of conclude that if people want to be afraid, nothing will stop them. And it's not clear that any kind of counterterrorism policy can do much about it. And so we sort of argue that counterterrorism people should be spending money responsibly. If they could actually reduce the fear by their expenditures, that might be a public good. In other words, even if the fear is not justified, quantitatively at least, if you can reduce people's unjustified fears, that's a good thing. It makes them feel better, and it's a public good. But clearly, that's not happening. The fears remain basically where they were at the time of 9/11. So consequently, the policy can't reduce people's anguish. And so, therefore, since you can't reduce their anguish, what you should be doing is something that's rational, which is spending the money, which in a manner that best reduces life, improves life safety, whether it affects public opinion one way or the other. So they're in some sense free to do this. The other aspect, though, of it is that pretty much what we see is not opinion leadership at all. It's the leaders are following the public. They realize and they think that if they do something wrong, bad, that they'll be cashiered later by public opinion or by the voters or by the taxpayers or something like that, or by inquests or whatever. So consequently, even if they are doing a good job in some respects, they have to pretend that they're assuaging these fears, and they also exacerbate them. But the thing about communism is good in that respect, because although they're public officials are all anti-communist and stuff like that, there was not much in the way of real hysteria in terms of public pronouncements after the 50s in particular. People went on to other things because there wasn't anything happening. There wasn't like somebody blowing up a defense factory someplace, like as I mentioned. So it isn't the incidence of the thing happening, and it isn't the degree to which the public officials hype the threat that's causing the fear. The fear is there regardless. Or another way of putting it, if the public officials did start speaking responsibly to a degree like Obama did for a while there, it wouldn't make much difference one way or the other. So they can't lower the fears, even if they consider them unjustified. If they do consider them justified, they're playing to they continue to play to the fears.
Is there any way to align the incentives of these agencies that are charged with both dealing with threats and assuaging fears, which are often different things? Is there any way to get their incentives aligned properly with respect to the true threat of terrorism?
Well, I've been working on it for, since 9/11, nearly 20 years now. And it seems to be a hopeless kind of situation. What happens for many issues of safety is that you're required to do a sensible cost-benefit analysis. If, for example, you decide maybe it'd be a good idea to require seatbelts in the back seats of cars, well, you have to do an analysis. You have to say how many lives would be likely to be saved, how much did the belts cost, what does it cost to retrofit cars and so forth, whatever it would be. And then your analysis is looked at. For the most part, and very, you know, vast majority part, they have not done that with Homeland Security. And so what we've been trying to do is to say, look, after 9/11, everybody panicked. Big surprise. You know, of course that happened. And so it's obvious to anybody that a lot of money was thrown at this problem very quickly. So after a while, I mean, that's understandable. It happened in your personal life, happened in your business life, you know. But after a few years, you'd go back and say, you know, I had to look at that money, but to throw at the problem. Some of the money I threw probably really does help. But some of it surely was wasted. It was foolish. And what I should do is go back and reevaluate and perhaps cut overall expenditures or move the money from procedures and methods that don't improve the risk, reduce the risk, from ones that do reduce the risk at an acceptable cost. And by and large, that simply has not been done. There's been virtually no consideration of acceptable risk. I've asked this even of one of the directors of the Transportation Security Administration. What's your goal? You can't save everybody's life on the airplanes except by closing down the airline industry. And you don't want to do that, right? And they say, yeah, we don't want to do that. So then I say, well, suppose that someone getting on board an airplane has one chance in a million of being killed by a terrorist. Is that acceptable? How about if it's 1 in 10 million? How about if it's 1 in 50 million? How about if it's about 1 in 80 million, which is more or less what it is? Even with 9/11 considered in the calculation. And they basically have no answer to that question. They have never even considered it.
John Mueller is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and co-author of Public Opinion and Counterterrorism Policy, available now. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.